Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today as we start the week and we sift through the results of the South Carolina primary and get ready for tomorrow's Nevada caucuses. So a lot going on in a very short period of time. Super Tuesday now just over a week away, and a lot will perhaps be decided through all those contests. But let's review South Carolina here on Monday. Obviously, Donald Trump doing very well, winning by about 10 percentage points over Marco Rubio, who then edged out Ted Cruz for second place. And then there was a huge drop-off from Cruz in third place to Jeb in fourth, Kasich fifth, Carson in sixth. No surprise that we're not thrilled with that result in terms of the top, with Trump continuing to win, but he won in impressive fashion again, even beating Cruz among evangelicals. The big news event on the Republican side, of course, Saturday night, other than Trump winning and winning decisively, was the fact that Jeb Bush finished a very distant fourth. Most of the reports suggest that his campaign was running very low on hard money. The donors were ready to go. And so Jeb Bush was smart enough to know when it was time to call it quits. Here's what he said.
I'm proud of the campaign that we've run to unify our country and to advocate conservative solutions that would give more Americans the opportunity to rise up and reach their God-given potential. But the people of Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina have spoken, and I really respect their decision. So tonight, I am suspending my campaign.
So, Jim, obviously not Jeb's year. It's the year of the outsider, so not good for a Bush in that sense. You point out in the Jolt today how much the name issue did impact him. He was at odds with the base on a couple of core issues, but in the end, he bowed out gracefully. So, Jim, please clap.
We should give Jeb Bush a little bit of applause. You know, to give him a little bit of applause because you think he's a good man who had a pretty solid record as governor and who just simply was out of step and out of touch and just didn't match the mood of the party this year. Or you could just applaud him because he's leaving. You really don't like him very much. There are quite a few folks who said this is great, but he could have done this 72 hours earlier and should have done it 72 hours earlier. There's been a lot of finger pointing, a lot of retribution, a lot of recriminations about how Jeb Bush ended up being so disappointing. Sixth place, I think, in Iowa, fourth place in New Hampshire, and then fourth place in South Carolina. Never caught fire, started out the front runner based on just name ID and then plummeted fast. You know, you could say he had a better campaign as it went on. He was better in the debates, but that was setting the bar low for those first couple performances. I think, look, ultimately, somebody early on needed to say to him, look, you've got very big issues with your family name. They want to like your brother. They have fond memories of your father, but they don't believe in the idea of dynastic politics. We don't have a royal family in the United States. And that's going to be a huge issue to overcome. And from that anecdote in that story I linked to in the Jolt, it sounds like they just kind of thought they could hand wave it away or the people would get over it. And they didn't. And I don't think the Bush campaign ever really had a great argument against that. Don't worry about dynasty politics, you know? And then, as you said, this is a fundamentally anti-Washington, anti-outsider, anti-establishment year. And Jeb Bush was probably the personification of the establishment, whether you think that's fair or not for a guy who really never worked in Washington and had been, you know, done most of his governing from Tallahassee. He was seen as the guy who represented the status quo. And whether or not that's fair, I don't think he ever did a major effort to dispel that. And ultimately, it's probably the argument you could make for Jeb Bush is that he realized out of three contests, there was no indication it was going to get better. And it was time to call it quits. So, Greg, maybe this is a good transition to our next martini. How do you think you feel when you're two spots behind Jeb Bush and he drops out?
Ben Carson finishes sixth, dead last among people who are still actively in the race. And decidedly so, even among the much lower second tier of candidates on Saturday night. But Ben Carson insists he's in this thing. He's not going anywhere. There's a story in the Hill today that says he's out of money. Never mind that. He's committed to these people in all these states, so he's going to stay in until whenever, I guess, when they're all over. Who knows? In the meantime, he's taking away 5, 6, 7% of votes from people who could potentially make a little bit of ground up against Donald Trump as the field hopefully continues to winnow. I think there'll be more calls for Kasich to do the same, although he insists he's staying in for Michigan and probably Ohio. So then you're left with the top tier that the top tier actually agrees is the top tier, which is Trump, Rubio, and Cruz. And as you point out, Jim, there's we're basically stuck, given the fact that there's still five people in this race, of largely a 40-30-30 situation right here with Trump. As long as there are five people in this race, there's never going to be a consolidation around an alternative, and that's very good news for Trump.
It is, and it might not be good news for Trump. I think it's very bad news for the Republican Party as a whole. First observation, look, Ben Carson is in single digits just about everywhere. It's tough to hear this message from the voters that, no, we don't want you. We like somebody else better. I think Ben Carson is a generally fundamentally decent man who may have entered this process a little bit naive. I've heard some people argue that his campaign basically amounts to a political consultant summer home financing plan with a decent candidate attached. That's a rather harsh assessment, but a lot of the fundraising money from Ben Carson's campaign goes right back into fundraising, building up that email list, building up that fundraising machine, but it doesn't actually seem to be getting Ben Carson votes. And when you're 6 out of 6 in South Carolina, what, you know, does Nevada take off for him? Does Florida, do any of those March 1st states, March 15th states? You know, there are no natural areas for these guys where you look and say, aha, that's where we're going to take off. Sort of a similar situation for John Kasich. I think the idea of his campaign is they want to be they call it a Midwest beachfront. If he does well in Michigan, if he does well in Ohio, if he does well in Pennsylvania, look, put me on the ticket. I'll help you carry Ohio. I'll help you carry the Midwest, and we win the presidency, and, you know, we have a happy presidency after that. I got to be honest, though. I looked at this, and he's not doing fantastic in Ohio. I believe Donald Trump is currently leading there. There's no indication he's doing particularly well in Michigan. There haven't been a lot of polling there, but the last one had him at 6%. I don't see any, you know, road ahead for these guys where they suddenly jump up and do a lot better. So that leaves Trump, Cruz, and Rubio. Different guys could win different states. I'm sure Ted Cruz thinks he's got a good shot at winning Texas. But for most of these states, it's easy to see it being, you know, Donald Trump has the largest plurality here. Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio may not be as evenly split as they were in South Carolina, but they're roughly evenly split there. So as you said, something in the neighborhood of 40-30-30, it's conceivable they go all the way to the convention like that. And then if it does split down with them having roughly that proportion of delegates, I don't see either Cruz or Rubio happily being the running mate of Donald Trump. Do you, Greg?
No.
Some people have floated the idea of a, you know, Rubio-Cruz or Cruz-Rubio unity ticket. And as much as that might make all of their supporters happy, you know, the 40% of the folks who voted for Donald Trump might say, hey, wait a minute, he won the most votes and he's not even the nominee. He's not even on the ticket. Having said that, it's just about unthinkable to think of Vice President Donald Trump.
No.
Right? You know, he doesn't take a back seat to anybody. I think you're going to end up with a 40% or so of the Republican Party being either very happy with or extremely devoted to the idea of Donald Trump as the nominee, and 60% and a good chunk of that 60% absolutely vehemently opposed to the Donald Trump as the nominee. I don't know how you square that circle. I don't know how you patch that up, because there's not a way you can make Donald Trump sort of the nominee. I don't think there's a cabinet position he wants. And so as a result of that, I think that you have a divided convention. And I think one of these two factions is going to walk away from the convention in Cleveland deeply, deeply dissatisfied with the result.
One thought here, Jim. You probably know the primary caucus calendar better than I do, especially about the delegate allocation. We're getting to the point where we hit some major winner-take-all states. So 40% is good enough to potentially get you over the top. If you keep winning 40% and finishing in first place, does that not get you the majority if you do it in the right states?
Yeah, and doesn't that kind of unnerve somebody? Like, as you're sitting there realizing, wait a minute, why would you set up? Obviously, this comes out of the 2012 experience. The party and Reince Priebus and the RNC all said, oh, look, it took too long for Romney to get the nomination. We need to have more winner-take-all states so we can pick our nominee quickly. Great call, Reince. Great call. Because now, let's say, you know, either Rubio or Cruz catches fire, and in some of these states, you know, they get like 39%. But if Trump has 40%, he gets all the delegates. Here's the thing. We get frustrated, and then we find new ways to louse it up, Greg. We find even more new ways to make it unfair. But I guess we're still behind the Democrats in this key category.
That's true. All right. Speaking of which, let's talk about the Nevada caucus. That went on throughout the day on Saturday. And, of course, Republicans will be there on Tuesday. It was believed to be a dead heat. It was very close. In the end, Hillary Clinton wins by about 5 points. Although, Jim, as you point out once again, we still don't really know what the vote totals were, because they only told us about allocation of state delegates, not the actual raw vote total, which might remind you of another caucus that happened a couple of weeks ago. So Bernie Sanders won New Hampshire overwhelmingly. We actually know the vote total there. Hillary Clinton apparently squeaked out a win in Iowa, and she won a fairly healthy and important win because she was definitely floundering heading into Nevada, but she did win. And now the media, of course, has decided that this has stopped people from feeling the burn anywhere else in America, and the handwriting's essentially on the wall, and this thing's all but over. So a good thing that the media is real consistent on these things. Hillary Clinton went from floundering herself and being on the brink of another colossal embarrassment to being the de facto nominee. It's amazing what 5% will do for you.
If you think of the national political media being having bipolar disorder, it makes a little more sense, or they're kind of, you know, manic depressive on her chances. You know, oh, my goodness, she's doing great. Oh, no, she's never going to win again. This started out as a state where she was way ahead long before anybody was taking Bernie Sanders seriously. And then, you know, this was a caucus state and people told us to be cautious about the polling there, but it looked like it was going to be fairly close. And it ended up being not, you know, not razor thin like Iowa, a decent win for Hillary Clinton. It beats losing. It beats a functional tie. But 52 to 47 is not this, you know, overwhelming majority, you know, and yet the tone of the coverage suggests, well, this is over. Now, the early entrance poll numbers suggest that she did well enough amongst Hispanics. She did relatively well amongst African-Americans. And those are demographics that are going to play a very big part in the primaries to come. Okay, fine. But you're seeing people act like basically it's a done deal here. And you look at the national polls, you know, Bernie Sanders is still only a couple of points behind. There's a chunk of the party that likes Bernie Sanders. And I can't imagine they're loving the fact that everybody is treating this thing as if it's all wrapped up. And if you say, oh, this, you know, there's a reason they're treating it all wrapped up, it's going to be almost impossible for Bernie Sanders to get ahead because he's only got 70 delegates so far and Mrs. Clinton has 502. Yeah, it's because of all the superdelegates, all the party elites lined up behind her. You know, like if we wanted to leave a whole bunch of really furious progressive grassroots folks who are not eager to vote for Hillary in the general election, it's working out perfectly, Greg. So, you know, this plan is working out very well. The Republicans look like the fair-minded party that gives everybody a fair shot and counts the votes. The other thing that's kind of amazing about this, Greg, we've had three contests on the Democratic side, Greg, and we're not allowed to know the vote totals for two of them. I guess they're keeping it on some sort of secure server.
They're going to have to put, like, quotation marks around Democratic Party. I mean,
oh, we've been arguing that for a long time, Greg. But yes, no, it's look at it this way. We don't like Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Democratic National Committee and the Clinton machine. But at least the good news is a whole bunch of progressives are starting to see why we don't like them right here and now. Yes. It can be a great unifying moment. We can all come together and dislike the Clintons.
Stay bitter, progressives. Remember this all the way through November.
Yes. No healing between in 2016. You know,
Jim, on that note, we'll reconvene tomorrow. Talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.